Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 15th through the 28th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Hello and welcome back to Chronicles, where today we're going to be talking all about King Charles III by Mike Bartlett, because I figured that after over 40 episodes of Chronicles now, it might not be the worst thing in the world for me to actually talk about something that was written and published within this century. So that's what I'm doing. I have a lot of literature, as you could quite imagine, back at home, but I honestly have so few plays written from the 21st century that really I was looking about and I was like, well, this is definitely one of the best of them, right? I actually, despite many of the things that I think will become apparent as we continue to talk about this play, so it's written in 2014, it won the Olivier Award for Best New Play in 2015, so it met with all of the approval from, you know, the arts institutions, and we know what they're like. So there's a lot in it. Right, there's a lot in it that, you know, sort of is conformist in many ways and not that radical. However, at the heart of it, I think that this play is asking a lot of really interesting questions about what does the monarchy, our monarchy, you know, which I'm sure needs no introduction, what does it mean to have a, you know, an institution that is essentially beyond, you know, ancient? It's, you know, kingship is, of course, the oldest and most natural form of government. And of course, for our own part as well, it goes right back to the core of our Anglo-Saxon heritage and has been there throughout all of our history, apart from that one very little Cromwellian blip in the 1600s, right? So what does it mean to have a monarchy and a king in the 21st century? What does it mean to have a monarchy and a king in a liberal, you know, in a liberal democracy? And I think the play asks all of these questions, and perhaps my opinions on the matter don't quite align, or are it not what Mike Bartlett quite envisaged when he first wrote this play. But I have to say, I really applaud him for his skill in making it, because it's quite an ambitious play to write in many ways. The first and most important point to make is that when a member of the royal family is speaking in the play, it is all written in a Shakespearean verse. It's written in the iambic pentameter. In making that choice, Mike Bartlett himself is quoted as saying, well, first, they are the country embodied, which is a very Shakespearean idea. And when you write about these specific people, you are then writing about the entire country. And so I think that that's a wonderful idea, and I think it's a wonderful innovation to have, that to write basically a Shakespearean history about our royal family in our present moment. And in that way, you know, it feels very organic to our own history, our own history of English literature, and obviously, you know, the titan that was Shakespeare as well. It's doing something that is reverent to his style and within our own heritage. But also at the same time, it manages to keep a lot of the Shakespearean formula as well. For example, when the commoners are speaking, it's written not in verse, but in prose. There's even a sort of like a side plot, a love plot, between Prince Harry and this girl called Jess, who's a fictional character made up for the play, where it's kind of like this like comedy side piece to the larger tragedy that is being played out with a lot of weight and gravitas. So in its formula as well, it is a very Shakespearean kind of play. But one of the things that I think that Mike Bartlett absolutely hits on when he talks about the fact that in some way the monarch embodies the entirety of the country is that when we think back to the great soliloquies, you know, of Henry V, for example, in the play that's, you know, takes his name by Shakespeare, when he's giving the St. Crispin's Day speech, or when he's doing the, you know, once more onto the breach, dear friends, once more, all of this feels like he is speaking for England, right? That there is the monarch's voice and the voice of the country itself are somehow one in the same. And I feel like that is something that, even if not as keenly felt today as it was in Shakespeare's time, certainly you will never catch me suggesting that somehow King Charles, the actual King Charles, speaks for the whole of Britain, would of course be very out of character for me, and obviously demonstrably untrue as well. But I think that that's another reason why it's a wonderful play to look at, because we here and now are drifting more and more into times where the monarchy has always faced a great deal of scrutiny from the left, right? They see the monarchy as the as sort of like the greatest example of inequality, of undeserved privilege, and basically just by your blood giving you certain power and access that is simply not available to us mere plebs. And all of this, of course, comes with a great amount of envy for the institution, and also, I think, as well, for how beloved it is in a way that they simply are not. But one of the other things as well is that we're seeing, as time goes on, and this is certainly true of myself and people I talk to from around our circles, and also seems to be borne out by polling, you know, that comes to us over the years since the Queen passed away, a growing dissatisfaction with the monarchy generally. It's not, you know, tipped into like, you know, 50% hatred or anything like that. There's still Charles's, you know, rating figures. He's still popular with about 65% of the country, but that's about 20% less than the Queen, the late Queen, was, you know, had towards the end of her reign. And when I think we, you know, hearken back and remember those final years of the Queen's life with the Platinum Jubilee, her example during COVID, you know, though I don't agree with COVID or the lockdowns or any of the stuff that was forced on us there, I suppose one of the things is that the Queen could not have claimed to have been above the rules, right? In fact, one of the things that we saw in the late Queen's example was that she was a greater believer in the rules than actually all of the politicians who'd put those rules in place in the first, you know, to begin with. So there is sort of like a moral example that monarchy can be at the best of times. And in many ways as well, because it is elevated above the din of Parliament and all of the corruption and avarice, true avarice, that we see from those chambers and the naked self-interest that they all pursue, I think that this endears a lot of people to the monarchy in a way that no one else could possibly command. And one of the, I suppose, the hallmark example of this, of course, was in the late Queen's death. And when, you know, tens of thousands of people came from all over the country to pay their respects, and I was among their number at that time. I was living in London. In fact, if you'll just allow me to reminisce for just a moment, one of the things that was most remarkable about joining the queue just after the Queen died was the fact that I went entirely alone. I didn't have anyone just local to me at that time who could go with me. And it was one of those things where I just knew that I'd actually be fine, right? I knew that I would get there, I would join the queue, and alone I would meet the good, decent, wonderful people of Britain, right? The actual British people. And that I would easily be able to make friends there and talk away however many hours it would be needed until I was stood there before her vigil in Westminster Abbey, able to pay tribute to her and give my respects. And there were so many people that I spoke with in that queue that they realised that they were doing something, they were genuinely participating in history, right? That's what was going on here. The death of the Queen brought people together. There was a unity and a common purpose uniting the nation in a way that was not remembered even in the, you know, sort of like a few decades preceding her, and certainly not for now in the decades after her passing, right? She was a very unifying figure. Even, and this is me saying this even as I am very aware of a lot of her shortcomings and the problems that her quote-unquote impartiality actually presented to our nation. But to do that and to see all of those people turning out there to pay their respects to her, well, that frankly is a kind of power and a magic within Britain and its monarchy that no other politician in the country would ever be able to command, right? No one who has stepped foot in the Houses of Parliament in my lifetime would able to be able to summon, you know, such loyalty at the end of their life. And so with that in mind, it's very interesting to see how Mike Bartlett handles this sort of like a fictionalized scenario in which the Queen does pass away and Charles becomes king. So this is very much a like a pseudo future history play that's being written. And I will just also say that many of the depictions of real life, you know, royal family members that you know, obviously from the news and, you know, whatnot, they are much, much more based in their portrayal in here than they are in real life. And so that will leave many of us very frustrated with the reality of the situation. But nonetheless, there is plenty to unpack here. So let's begin to talk all about King Charles III. During the early decades of the 21st century, the British public mark the passing of their late monarch. The sombre pageantry of the funeral procession dutifully proceeds, giving memory and honour to the life of Elizabeth II. By the grace of God, of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and of her other realms and territories, Queen, head of the Commonwealth and defender of the faith. After the grand service held in Westminster Abbey, a grief-stricken Charles is surrounded by his family, Camilla, his rock and consort, William and Kate, his pride and hope, and briefly, Harry, who pathetically feigns a headache so that he might spurn his duty. Instead, he goes to the club to live his tormented, libertine existence when his friends introduce him to Jess, a middle-class attendee of art school. Studying the relationship between pornography and Islam, she embodies all that is the modern woman. Without any pretense for status, she starts to question Prince Harry about his role and how obviously unhappy he is, trapped within such a rigid institution. Harry is taken aback by her candour, and the two spend the night about London. By tradition's grace, Charles is now king, and the affairs of state require his attention, and he holds his first meeting with Mr. Evans, the Prime Minister of His Majesty's government and leader of the Labour Party. The new king has a particular interest in the bill that awaits his royal assent. Once law, it would heavily subdue the liberties of the press in response to their immoral dealings during the phone hacking scandal. You like this bill? I absolutely do. For we have seen, and you yourself must know too well, the lasting wounds the press inflict. We cannot risk another murder case where phones belonging to the dead are hacked. It cannot be a right or civilised country in which, in any private place, a toilet, bedroom, might be there concealed a tiny camera, then these photos splayed as front page news, the consequences thrown around the world and everlasting. So without a jury, judge or evidence, a punishment is meted out, a life is ruined, reputation murdered.
You do not think a principle is here at stake, that something vital to our sense of freedom, both as individuals and country whole, is being risked?
Your Majesty, of course I understand that view and have myself considered where the balance lay. But both within the House of Commons and in every poll conducted across the land, there is opinion something must be done. The law is what your people want.
They want the leaders they elected standing up and making choices they themselves cannot. Because they have not time, they pay their taxes well, so we, or you, may take the time to study hard and make the right decision on the day.
I know, I have, and this is what we think. I have to say it does surprise that with the great intrusion that they have made into your life, you'd have them left unchecked like this. What of the pack of wolves that mercilessly did hunt to death your late and much-missed wife?
That's bold, so soon in our relationship.
What's bold? To utilise Diana.
I'm sorry, but in fact it's rare to have to justify the passing of a law like this. I would have thought that of all the victims you'd feel the strongest something must be done.
As a man, a father, husband, yes, I do. But that's not who we are when sat with you. In here, not just am I defender of the faith, but in addition I protect this country's unique force and way of life. We are not strong for manufacturing. Politically, our sway and influence are in decline. But still, we demonstrate the way a just society should work. Judiciary, democracy, and more. A low corruption rate. All those who hold the strings held to account themselves in turn.
After a frosty meeting, Mr. Evans departs, and Mr. Stevens, a Tory leader, enters for an audience.
I do not think it right.
It is too late, and so the first law passed as king will be a law that's dangerous. I always hoped as crown I'd have some small but crucial influence upon the state. I'd given all my working life to serve. But Mr. Evans does not like me, and has made explicit that he will not change a single thing in light of what I say. And if this is the case, then what am I? My mother gained experience from what she'd seen. The Blitz. She sat with Churchill and met all the most important figures of her years. But what am I?
It may not be too late to stop the war.
But Houses, Parliament and Lords have cast their votes, and therefore when I sign the bill, if you sign the bill, for surely that requirement remains your choice, that is, the power you possess. A ceremonial right, not one to use.
I hate to differ, but I think this strikes the heart of why we have a queen or king. They are the check and balance of our land.
After days of private stalemate, the Prime Minister returns, insisting that the king relent and sign the bill. William and Kate find him awaiting an audience in such a tense state that he reveals a crisis to Kate, who urges William to intercede and persuade the king to back down. But William wishes to support his father, and so Mr. Evans confronts the king alone.
You have not changed a word.
It is the same. Were there solution evident that could enable both of us to have our way, I'd take it in an instant, for I know you're acting out of conscience.
That's right. And in good conscience, I have thought that, come the moment, surely I could sign, but when the pen approaches paper thus, about to store forever my assent, and tell the future generations that King Charles did let this happen, and in proof applied the value of his name beneath, the pen dries up, my hand it cannot write. For if my name is given through routine, and not because it represents my view, then soon I'll have no name, and nameless I have not myself, and having not myself, possess not mouth, nor tongue, nor brain. Instead I am an empty vessel waiting for instruction, soulless and uncorporate. And like I saw on television when I was a younger man, I'm Charles no more the human being, but transformed into a spitting image puppet, lying prone upon the table, waiting for some man to come, and then inserting his own hand, do operate the image of the king, pretending life, a simulation of the outer skin with nothing in the heart.
This is your role,
you surely must have known, but I'm not sure if ever in the past there was such a bill that changed the way that speech is granted freedom. Not since the news was born has government and state been there allowed to use the threat of jail to stop the presses, based on what they deem is unacceptable. The Queen did not in all her years bethroned face laws like this to pass. I do agree, for in her time she faced a far greater revolution, when she lost an empire. Granted that the law on homosexuality be changed, she oversaw the altercation from the unions, mines and factories that stood for generations to a world that Thatcherated, Reaganized, to place a profit higher value than the pride belonging to the man who travels day by day upon the Clapham omnibus. And through all this, when laws arrived from those prime ministers she hated, doing things of which she never would approve, she still did sign. Respected all the votes empowering those elect to make the law, she always signed. She always gave assent. Well, I cannot. The monarch and the minister both address the nation, appealing to the British public. Mr. Evans addresses the people outside No. 10 Downing Street. With the bill concerning privacy and statutory regulation of the press, the King has unexpectedly refused to grant assent on grounds that he does not concur with what it does intend. I have done all I can to ease his mind, but he is not persuaded, and despite his certain knowledge that the royal assent is ceremonial and not a tool, he has continued to withhold his pen. We're currently negotiating still in order to progress, but here I say importantly that first we must defend democracy itself, and leave aside our diverse views on what the bill contains. So to this end, I will here make a pledge that either printed with the royal sign or standing firm without his regal sign, the measure will be law within the month. King Charles III then speaks from Buckingham Palace to the people via television. I'm speaking from the palace to you all, reluctantly tonight. I had a hope my ministers and I could find a way to circumvent a public feud like this. But, driven by my conscience, I have declined to pass a law that would give government the right and power to restrict and then decide what is acceptable to say in print. Once fragile politicians can, while claiming public sensitivity, go censoring what's writ or not, it will be easier to govern as corrupt than bother being held unto account. And therefore I, who stand outside the rough and tumble of expedience, do caution them, and ask they think again. So far they have refused, so now do I, as king and servant to the populace, request your understanding and your trust, that this, a rare but necessary act, is not me stepping too far from the throne, but is my duty and fulfilling what the king or queen is sworn by oath to do. The kingdom holds its breath, tumbling into an instability unknown during the late queen's reign. But whilst high-minded questions are asked and asked again about the political unrest, Jess has an audience with James Rees, the king's press secretary. Her blossoming romance with Prince Harry is becoming increasingly public as they are ambushed by cameras and the hounds of journalists that hold them. Jess informed James that an ex-partner has gotten into contact with her and means to sexually blackmail her by passing materials to the press. Meanwhile, at Buckingham Palace, King Charles III measures the mood of his subjects. Opinion polls suggest that people are divided almost equally as to if my non-signing is within my rights or not. But that's half far more than I expected would agree with me on this. Whatever many like to think, there is a wise and ancient bond between the crown and population of this present isle. It is only in the last 500 years that politicians and democracy have led the way in policy and meant the people vote for who they want to lead. And this is right, but unlike countries which did build existence through the parliament, this is to us an option added on. Like sat-nav on a car, it does not come as standard, and the car will function well without. It drives, protects, it normally goes.
And though it's wise to pay for extra help, and usually the voice of the machine assists us well to get from A to B when lost, and crisis strikes, we soon mistrust these modern ways and reach for what we know. We seek the map from years before, and there do stabilize and rescue our way.
Mr. Stevens then comes to the King and tells him that Parliament means to outmaneuver him by passing an act that will grant them the license to empower their own bills without the royal signature. The last vestiges of the royal voice muted.
Mr. Stevens suggests His Majesty reacquaint himself with the reign of King William IV and his decisive example in 1831.
As a fateful decision awaits Charles, both he and William are separately visited by the ghost of Diana, who tells them both that they will be the greatest kings. On the day of the vote, the Speaker of the House addresses the Commons.
Order! Order! This House will come to order now at once. We here discuss a move to raise ourselves out from the overseeing shadow that for centuries has held us to account. And so it's not the moment to become a bunch of children stamping up and down. Both major party leaders will now speak, and then will vote at once, and there forthwith, if passed, by special measures made, the bill will straight go to the House of Lords, who wait upon us even now to take this vote. So first, the Leader of the Opposition.
I thank you, Mr. Speaker, and because we know the facts upon the matter well, I will unusually be very brief. Our Parliament exists to make sure that the people of our country do decide the codes and principles by which they live. It is a contract made between the man or woman and the state, by which both sides must there agree that citizen does have a voice and in return will keep the law. And so an intervention in this way that so removes the voice but keeps the law is absolutely wrong. And in this House, we must every vote support this vital bill. He sits and there are cheers. I make assumption that we all will vote in favour of this bill, for we all here now have made a choice to come and represent constituents to have their say in this, their House, and give their weight and influence to the shaping of the government and law. Although we have the crown as head of state, both history and precedent do hold him in his place. And now he oversteps, we must act, and not impertinent or rude or out of disrespect, but since we have no other choice than to protect our democratic British way of life. More cheers, and the Prime Minister sits. And now, by ancient process, we divide the House and... We will divide the House to vote ayes to the... Please will someone, before we vote, go see what causes this infernal knocking there? King Charles III walks into Parliament, without a crown, but regally dressed, and with his sceptre. The members of Parliament stand, and Charles stands opposite the Speaker. Empowered by ancient decree, I do, as King of England, Northern Ireland, Wales and Scotland, use my royal prerogative to here dissolve the Parliament at once. Parliament erupts in protest.
Order! Order! I will have silence now.
This noise demeans you all. Is this a space where public will is spoken, heard, or just a stand for juvenile and selfish squall? Through petty theft and fighting here amongst yourselves, you've lost the population's trust, and I am not prone to certainty, but you have drawn that measure in my unsure heart. Unlike you all, I am born and raised to rule. I do not choose, but like an Albion oak, I'm sown in British soil, and grown not for myself, but reared with single purpose meant. While you have small constituency support, which gusts and falls, as does the wind, my cells and organs constitute this land, devoted to entire populace, of now, of then, and all those still to come. And in their interest, in their voice, the Speaker knows it is within my right to sack my ministers and call a fresh election.
The King then dissolves Parliament. Before long, from the denizens of Durham to the people of Penzance and the masses of Manchester, allegiance is asundered.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.